When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul and AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 4, titled Hit and Run. Alexis, what'd you think about this episode?
First off, I would like to offer some congratulations to Rae Seahorn for her directorial debut. Debussy.
Debut.
Debussy. congratulations. And this episode gave us Jimmy Hamlin, so no matter what.
Oh my God.
No matter what, I have to give it that.
Jimmy doing Howard face? Is that even legal? Is that unethical at best?
It's an unethical joke at best.
Yeah, that was incredible. I was shocked to see how much Jimmy actually looked like Howard with just a little bit of hair and makeup.
Yeah, he's a middle-aged white man playing another middle-aged white man.
Is he a white man in this? He's got a lot
question.
Of bronzer on.
Did kind of, yeah, it went a little crazy with the sunless tanner.
Significantly less white than normal. But yes, yeah, that was pretty thrilling, pretty outstanding.
I was also really happy to see all the characters from Breaking Bad that showed up in this episode.
Such as
Wendy.
Yeah.
Wendy. And Spooge, who we were just talking about in the last episode.
Were we? Oh, boy.
We did.
Yeah, I thought we mentioned dropping an ATM on somebody.
It was Spooge.
Yeah.
Appropriately.
Yeah.
You got another? You got more?
No, I think that's it, right?
I hope that's it. I didn't actually list them.
Yeah, pretty sure that's it.
Cool.
I thought this episode was good, but it's clearly set up, right?
It's very much set up.
Like, without the Howard Hamlin heist, there wouldn't be much to talk about of, like, significant movement in this episode. We get to see, okay, Gus has, like, a super secret Batcave entrance to his house.
Mm-hmm.
He's very, very paranoid, even more so than we thought before. You get to see, you know, Jimmy doing a little dance around Howard here. And then you get to kind of see Kim, I don't know, also be looking over his shoulder and worried, paranoid.
And definitely at the end, at night, in a random strip mall, I would be looking over my shoulder too, even if I didn't know that Lala was on my butt.
Yeah, but there's not a ton else happening in this episode, right? It's all just setting
not
up.
Really, it's mostly set
stuff.
Up. I do wonder if it may have served the pacing of this episode a little bit better if the fun Jimmy Hamlin stuff had been more toward like the end of the episode.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Because once that was over, they didn't really give us a lot of like fun stuff to sink our teeth into. It was mostly set up and a little bit of character development.
And it wasn't like a huge reveal with Gus, right? Like, Gus is paranoid. Okay. I mean, look at the lengths he went to with his laundromat.
Yeah.
That bunker that he created underground. Of course. He's
true.
Very careful.
He's the underground man. Yeah.
Yeah, apparently. Does everything underground. But yeah, that wasn't like a big reveal to be blown away by, right? So at least if you could have had some fun at the end of this episode, it might have been a little better feels coming out of it. But I don't know. Maybe people were thrilled by seeing Gus, how like far he's willing to go for security's sake at this point.
Also answers, I think, a couple of questions from Breaking Bad in terms of Walt just showing up to Gus's house and how much of a joke we know that is now.
Yeah,
showing up with a gun like he was going to be able to do anything, because joke's on you, dumbass. He's surveilling his own house from across, because of course he is. He's Gus.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this carries over into Breaking Bad. Does he still go through all these motions if he's got, after he takes out Juan Bolza, Does he still look over his shoulder as much?
It's a good question. It does seem like he maybe feels a little bit safer once we get into Breaking Bad territory.
Yeah, I would think so.
And I think the ending of this season will answer a lot of those questions for us.
Totally. Yeah, especially once Eladio is out of the way, he probably feels a lot more secure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you want to say anything else about the episode, or should we get it right into the recap?
Nope, let's do it.
All right.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
So we open on a bike riding couple cruising through an upper class neighborhood and arriving home, where they appear to be Gus's neighbors.
Yeah. Don't bother asking questions like what the fuck in these cold opens, because we know they'll answer by the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the episode. I got a little thrown by last week's for sure. Yeah. We'll talk about that at the beginning of feedback, but you know, they typically do this, and by the mm-hmm. end you'll understand it. So I'm not like too crazy. I felt like this didn't seem connected at all to anything, which is not always the case with these cold opens. Like I remember, you know, the ice cream cone with the ants, that was pretty obvious what that was about, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, this one was fine. I don't know. And I guess the explanation we get at the end is fine, but it's like a half explanation, right? It's like, okay, this is what Gus is doing, but it's like, okay, what is he waiting for? Is he waiting for the Salamancas to make a move on him so that he can catch him? Is this like when he had Nacho out in the motel and had people surveilling, waiting for the assassins to come, right?
That would be my assumption, but I don't have a mountain of evidence to support that.
Yeah. I don't know. So we'll see. There's a big red house in this neighborhood, which, you know, red is a scary color. Tomato red, fire engine red, very scary for this couple.
Well, the fact that the freaking episode is titled Hit and Run, every time I saw somebody in a car, period, in this episode, I was waiting for them to hit somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. Or biking down the street.
Right, yeah. I was super worried for this couple, who's actually a couple in real life.
Oh, are they? Okay, yeah. Cool.
And that house, don't worry. There is no house, at least on that street, that's actually painted that color red. It's good. Digital.
Yeah.
I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why people get so upset about other people's paint color choices. It's fine. Whatever. It's a color.
Yeah.
Anyway, red in Breaking Bad universe is usually a pretty dangerous color.
It's fair.
And we know that, like, this is in Gus's neighborhood, so maybe this is, like, supposed to put us on high alert for Gus, which kind of works but doesn't work because we know Gus is fine in Breaking Bad when we catch back up with him. So
it's true.
Is it going to be weird having two seasons of Breaking Bad without Gus at all? Just like going to this entirely different story and then coming back eventually to Gus?
I think it suits the story, the way they played it out. I think it'll be okay.
Okay. I don't know. I feel like some people, if you're watching Better Call Saul first, might be like, well, where's Gus? I want to know more about his story, because his story's obviously not going to end right now, and might get impatient with the first two seasons of Breaking Bad. Although...
But they're so good.
There's nothing to be impatient
with. Yeah, they stand on their own. I honestly... Real talk, first and only watch through of Breaking Bad, I got a little annoyed with the family stuff, with Walt and his family. I'm like, yep, cool. This is a family scene. Okay. Can we move on?
The talking pillow, you didn't like that stuff? All right.
Nope.
All right.
All right. Then we get the title sequence, and we afterward cut to Howard arriving at his therapy session with some smooth jazz, like you do. And mid-session, Jimmy sneaks off with Howard's car.
I love this when Howard pulls into the spot and gets out of his car and then turns around and locks his car. I have never done anything with as much intentionality in my entire life as Howard locks his car with. Like, the way he turns around, smiles at his car, presses the button at it. It takes him a good 10 seconds to lock this car.
Yeah.
Me, I would just be sticking my keys in my pocket, hitting the button, and continue walking. Howard, like, takes a moment to savor it. And I don't know if this is his new namaste, like, mindfulness journey that he's been on.
Yeah.
But he seems, like, totally blissed out just locking his car remotely.
That is fair. I have to question that, too, because that locking sound is so loud. And it was loud later on in the episode. I was very worried for Jimmy. But you could just be hitting that button and walking away from your car. You could tell that it was locked.
Yeah.
You're totally right. I think it is a namaste thing.
It must be.
Anonymous three.
I mean, very mindful.
Mm-hmm.
And with Jimmy, boy, driving up, taking Howard's car, I like I said, I'm just shocked how much they made him look like Howard, especially from the back. Like, you
from the
basically
back, yeah.
Can't tell.
Oh, I love, by the way, that such a fun cut. Howard beginning to describe this dream he had, and then you cut to Jimmy's back walking as though it is Howard, as though we're picturing Howard's dream. And my first thought was, oh, cool, a dream sequence. We never see that in this show. And then you see the dangling remote and you're like, oh, wait, how would he know about that? And then the juicy reveal. The juicy reveal.
I mean, more disguised like Howard now than even when he pulled the billboard stunt back in season one.
Yeah.
Do you think he held on to that suit? Is that why he still
absolutely.
Has the suit?
Have you seen that man? He holds on to every suit.
That's true.
Every suit he's ever bought. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was a nice little callback that he would already have that suit.
So good. I guess he must have just put... Do you think it was like the world's thinnest wig, or was it some kind of powder or something that he spread through his hair to give it that blonde salt and pepper effect?
I assume he could probably
just... Because later
in
the episode, he's got normal hair again.
Yeah. It must have been a wig. You're right.
Hmm. Wow. Hmm. Make wigs like that, huh? Cool.
I guess so. The other thing that I was watching for this episode is when I saw Jimmy take his car, the first thing that happens when he turns it on is the smooth jazz starts playing and Jimmy's like, ugh, and turns it off. Like, he better turn that back on because Howard might remember that he left that on. But it turns out Howard is so not observant.
Yeah, like his mindfulness shit, like, right?
extends to locking his car, but not like paying attention to where he parked and
whether or not he's parked on yellow lines. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Insane. In the next scene, we cut to Kim fidgeting while waiting for Cliff at a cafe where they end up talking business.
I couldn't figure out why Kim was so shifty in her seat. On the first watch. On the second watch, I realized
she's getting the perfect angle for comedically looking over her shoulder like, what?
Yeah.
Howard Hamlin?
And making sure she doesn't obstruct Cliff's view of the car is like probably priority number one.
Definitely.
Scoot over a little bit so you can see it. And I realized also that this is why they were so concerned about the April 18th date and not being able to get the plates in time and the car. And so they had to steal Howard's car because they needed this car on the day that Cliff was going to be in town. Like he doesn't come to town very often.
They do.
And they had this lunch date.
Mm-hmm.
So it made a lot more sense in retrospect that they were talking about the 18th and we don't have time. And
right. And then Cliff, bless him, he ends up dropping a little bit of an emotional bomb on Kim, which is that we learn that his son has drug problems.
Yeah. Do you think they knew that was the case? Because Kim seems to know that's the case.
I don't think they knew. I feel like her face fell a little bit when he said that. Like,
maybe so.
Man, drugs, and he's familiar with drugs. Crap.
Yeah, they planted those drugs in Howard's locker. I wonder if I just wonder, did they know that? And this would be kind of like a bugaboo for Cliff.
Maybe. It's a good question.
Because it does add a little extra spice onto that.
It does. Anything else you want to say about this particular scene? It's pretty short.
About Wendy? Yeah. Isn't this the same scene, or is this is all kind of happening at the same time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the scenes are split in an interesting way in this episode, where a lot of the scenes take place in more than one location.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to say what is actually the next scene, but I do have here, Jimmy shows up at Wendy's and picks her up in Howard's car, and they sit and wait for Kim's signal.
Yeah, and this is a callback to the root beers and everything. Like, this
yes.
is...
Man, just let her have her freaking root beer. You're going to be right. sticking your boot in her butt in like 20 minutes. Just let her have a root beer.
Maybe he didn't want it in his car after he kicked her out, because she wasn't going to have time to grab it.
Maybe he's worried about spilling root beer in the car. Oh.
Yeah, you spill that root beer, Howard's going to know.
Game's over. Yeah.
No time to clean it up.
You can't wipe root beer off of leather seats. Everybody knows that. I don't know that.
Or he just didn't want to have to deal with it, right? Like, he's going to kick her out. She's not going to grab a root beer on the way out, being kicked out the door. He's going to have a bottle he's got to manage. It's going to be annoying.
He's talking about how they're short on time, and it's taking him longer to tell her to not get a root beer and also to get out and physically grab her and then walk all the way around the car and get in the seat again. Like, come on. But I'm sure he had his reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to cut back to Kim and Cliff, and they're having a chat when Jimmy Hamlin comes by and drops Wendy off.
He comes flying in.
He really
like, tires screeching, fast and furious, Tokyo drifting in there.
It was trying to be seen. Yeah. Definitely. Why would Howard drop a sex worker off just in the middle of friggin' nowhere?
I don't know.
Is he coked out of his brain? Was that what we're supposed to be understanding here?
And Cliff has to bring this up, right?
Mm-hmm. Right?
I mean, and then, it's going to be the very next thing they talk about when they see each other.
Yeah, and like, is he not going to know the time? How is Howard not just going to say, yeah, I was in therapy at that time? Is it just going to be his word against
I guess, but his therapist could back him up. It's just a matter of, like, I don't know. I don't know. Will Cliff believe him? And if you can mount enough evidence on top of other pieces of evidence, right, then eventually Cliff will just buy it.
I guess so. I there are so many just question marks hovering around this whole plan that they have, because it does... Just looking at it from the outside, just with the little bits of information that we have so far, it does seem a little sloppy compared to some of their other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they're working on a specific timeline in this particular instance.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to get things done. And I don't know. It seems like I'm waiting for the counter move, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why I'm expecting it, but I'm waiting for Howard to put up a fight. Because I've always just viewed Howard as a fairly smart guy and fairly observant. And so when he sees all these bad things happening to him and he remembers that Jimmy did this stuff before with bowling balls and prostitutes. And
right. How is he not... Same question that we had in previous episodes. How is he not just immediately going to know that this is Jimmy?
Right. And he can't prove it, right? I mean, that's the thing. That's the other part of this episode where Jimmy is like walking through the courthouse and everybody's giving him the cold shoulder. Mm-hmm. And even Bill. And then Bill tells him there's knowing it. There's proving it and there's knowing it. And I feel like Howard can't prove anything, but Howard knows. And Chuck, just like Chuck always knew, right? It's, everybody knows Jimmy. That's the story of his life. Nobody can ever pin anything on him because he's better than that. But also, everybody knows he's scum.
Shady.
He's a bottom feeder.
Shady.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know. I'm looking for Howard to fight back in some way, but I don't see the connective tissue there yet.
Yeah. I don't even know what that looks like. I mean, you're talking about Howard fighting anything.
Yeah. I mean,
if he can't be
private eyes and
if he can't be like good postured and crisp syllabled about it, then I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what his defense is.
I don't either, but I'm hoping to see something from him.
Yeah, I hope so too. Oh God. Continuation of this scene. Jimmy is trying to put Howard's car back where he found it, but someone moved the cone. Who does that? So he takes matters in his own hands.
I thought at first this might be Ken Wins because it was a BMW, and that dude drives a BMW. But it's not. It's not the Ken Wins license plate. But yeah, and I thought, well, okay, what would I do if I'm in this situation? I might try and run into the closest like building and see if someone, you know, like calling in a thing at, I don't know, a department store and saying, hey, could the owner of a white Chevy Camaro come to the parking lot? Your car is being towed or whatever.
I definitely, I feel like that's more what I would do too. I definitely would not physically rip a sign out of its moorings and replant it.
Because it only holds up if he's not observant, right?
Yeah.
If he's not mindful of his surroundings. Because, I don't know about you, but I have never accidentally parked on a striped space before. And if I did, I think I would notice immediately when I came out.
Yeah.
Back to my car. But I don't know. Howard seems pretty oblivious here.
It's pretty shaky. It's pretty shaky. I do kind of love it, though. And I love Jimmy reenacting it for Kim later. It's cute.
Yeah. The bronzer that he's wearing to look like Howard is rubbing off on his cuffs and stuff, which I thought was a nice touch.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, when he's trying to rip the sign out, I noticed there was a little bit of bleed onto his shirt.
That's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we are cutting back to Kim as she drops Wendy off with what Wendy says is an undercover cop nearby, who then follows Kim out of the parking lot.
I wonder how she got into this particular scenario. Did she volunteer? Like, did she tell Cliff, oh, I'm going to go help this person when they saw her thrown out in the street, volunteer to drive her back to her house or whatever?
It's my assumption.
It's like play the Good Samaritan, which ingratiates you to Cliff even further at the same time that you're tearing down Howard.
Yeah. I did see some people being a little fussy that she gave Wendy her business card, but like Cliff already saw her driving her and dropping her off.
Yeah,
so
I think
cares?
Cliff knows that she took her back to wherever she wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my assumption.
It's my assumption too. I could be wrong. I don't know. Speaking of Kim again, we are back with Kim and Jimmy at home and they're talking about their day.
Yep. This is you think we're wicked scene. That's like the biggest thing that sticks out to me in this scene. It's like, I think Jimmy does think a little bit like that. That, maybe what they're doing is not justified.
Which is a bit silly, considering all the stuff that he's pulled before. But it says, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. That was a good line.
I remember back in the last season when they were, like, in their blanket fort or whatever in bed talking about doing this whole plan. And he's like, not sure about it. Cause he's not sure that Howard deserves it. And like, they're determining, you know, what's evil versus good and using their powers for that. And Jimmy, doesn't really see what they're doing as justified, I don't think.
I think you're probably right. I do think that he has realized over time with Chuck's death and everything that Howard was not really the one who was against him the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's also, it seems like he has done the work to try to come to terms with a lot of this stuff. Howard has done the work to come to terms with a lot of the stuff that's going on. Oh, I didn't even mention this. I forgot. In the therapy session earlier, we learned that Howard has a wife, apparently, and that things are not going well.
I don't know why I never pictured him having a wife. I just assumed he was a bachelor.
Yeah, but I don't know why. Because he's so stiff, I guess, maybe.
I guess, maybe because we see everybody else's relationships and they're talking about either ex-wives or girlfriends or
whatever. Because we've literally never seen Howard outside of a work context.
No, never.
Wow. Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It seems like, I mean, I guess we're going to have to get more into that if they're going to ruin his life.
I guess the one time we
his
did.
His life and reputation.
If we did see it is... Yeah, I mean, that adds a whole other dimension to what's
like,
going on
he's
here.
He's already... He has other stuff that he's been dealing with, and then now this is going to be coming.
Yeah. If his marriage is already on the rocks, it's going to be...
Oh, God, yeah. And then it comes out that he has a drug and sex worker problem.
It makes me wonder why his wife wasn't getting up in the middle of the night when bowling balls were raining on their house.
Right.
And kind of looking out the window with him.
Yeah. Maybe she sleeps with earplugs or something.
Must.
She's completely checked out of life. Mm-hmm. I don't know. She doesn't want to talk about anything serious, apparently. Maybe she doesn't want to hear anything serious either.
The other line that I liked in this is when Jimmy's talking about like why she feels like there are people following her and why she's feeling that way. And he says, the thing about the wicked flee when no man pursueth or whatever. But he says, really, the reason is you're feeling this way because we got away with it. Mm-hmm. And you just feel like it's too good to be true. It's like I did something wrong. I should be punished for it. And I'm not being punished. When will I be punished?
Sounds like the voice of experience. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm sure he felt that years and years ago when he started pulling these scams. He's very familiar with that. And I think that strikes me as very true also. Like anytime I pulled something off that I got away with that I didn't think I should be able to, I always feel for a very long time, and especially some... Like scams this big, I'd be like the rest of my life just looking over my shoulder going, well, when is the other shoe going to drop? When am I going to get punished for this?
What is worth that level of anxiety?
Millions right? Like you go rob maybe. A bank, you get $1 million, but then the rest of your life you're spent just looking over your shoulder constantly
just
forever.
Tense all the time. Yeah, you could never relax. What good is that?
Gus lives a terrible life as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
A life of isolation and paranoia.
I don't...
Forever.
I don't
Why
think he
do
is,
that?
He hasn't smiled a sincere smile for probably 10 years.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know.
No thanks.
Seems hard, but I guess some people choose to do it that way. Yes. So the next day, we follow Jimmy into the courthouse where everyone stonewalls him, including Sweaty Bill. Even Sweaty Bill. I've never actually seen him sweat, but his demeanor seems sweaty to me.
Yeah. He's constantly damp from the neck down.
Damp
that suit.
And full of Fritos. Oh, he's got that puppy feet breath, probably.
Puppy feet breath?
Or is that Doritos? Yeah, there was a thing. And maybe somebody else will remember this. You apparently don't.
Nope.
There was a thing a while back where I think it was actually Doritos. Doritos smell like puppy feet is what people like to claim.
I don't think I've ever smelled puppy feet, for one. So I couldn't tell
Not
you.
Not deliberately, no.
It's like when people say something literally tastes like shit, I go, how do you know? How do you know what puppy feet taste like? What are you out there,
tastes
you perverts?
Tastes like?
Out there licking puppy feet.
Gross. You don't know. You don't know where those have been, but... You can probably guess. Puppies are messy. They step in their own poop all the time. It's crazy.
It's true.
Anyway, I really like at the end of this scene how we have this character who has been sort of a running joke for the better part of the series, and he actually displays a little bit of like dignity. It was really interesting to see. Yeah. It's just like this, like.
I mean, when he tells you you're just wrong, it's like that's as low as you get, right?
Yeah, in a stairwell with paint peeling, and yeah, you've reached a low place. His Beanie Babies didn't work. That's sad. He had to take off all his crap at security. Mm-hmm. That's annoying.
Yeah, and I mean, all this points to the fact that the ADA threw him under the bus, right? Because mm-hmm. she's the one that put all this stuff together. She's the one who approached Kim, and because Kim didn't play ball here, she's ruining his reputation. This feels like a reverse Howard, right? Like, or the Howard being pulled on Jimmy a little bit. And it's not as like scammy and scummy as what they're doing to Howard, but it's the same thing. She's destroying his reputation.
She's definitely salted the earth. Yeah, I don't think he will ever be treated the same in that courthouse.
No. And I mean, it's all... It's not as devious as what's happening to Howard because Jimmy did all this stuff, right? He deserves this.
Yeah, no, but... he did do the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is deserved, but also a little sad to see him so isolated. Mm-hmm. I do think they did a really good job showing that isolation.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And the next scene with him sitting at the lunch tables there. And
all by
nobody's
himself.
Sitting next to him
high
offering a seat,
again. Yep.
Clearing a seat for people. They walk past him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's okay because he's getting a lot of business.
He's getting money, and that's what he cares about, right?
Yeah.
He thought. Yeah.
Is this the first time he's used this Bluetooth earpiece? I don't know. Maybe the audience is aware of this, but
I don't remember.
This is something that he constantly had in Breaking Bad.
Yep.
This is like a signature Saul thing. It's actually, in my mind, a signature Ken Wynn's thing as well, that dude, mm-hmm. which, you know, he's not in this episode, but I feel like in spirit he's in this episode because he's the kind of douchebag who would get out, move a cone, and park in somebody's spot.
Yeah.
He's the same guy who uses this earpiece all the time in public.
Might have to remind some of the people who Ken Wynn's is.
Oh, yeah. So he's the guy that they scam at the bar. And is he the guy that they get to buy a bunch of Zafiro Añejo or Zafiro, whatever, like thousands of dollars worth?
I think it might be. Yeah. I think it was that scam. It was basically just them getting free booze.
Yeah, totally. Scamming him for free booze. And he's also in Breaking Bad, one of the, that's where you're introduced to him if you watch them in order of release. And he is at like a gas station being a real douchebag, and Walt's like having a bad day or something, I think, and ends up blowing up his car. Yeah, and it's that BMW.
I remember that, but yeah, okay. Oh, that's juicy.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So there's another Breaking Bad character in this episode. Third one.
In spirit, yeah.
In spirit?
Uh-huh. I mean, it's not actually his car. It's the same kind of car he drives. But why I call him Ken Wynn's is because he literally has a license plate on it, a vanity plate that says Ken Wynn's.
Ken Wynn's, yeah. I remember. That was for the audience. That's why I asked. Okay. It wasn't. I don't remember who he was. I gotta stop telling on myself.
Yeah.
Next, we see Kim again. Boy, I tell you what, whenever you don't have Nacho around anymore, you can really spend time on Kim and Jimmy. Mm-hmm. But we see Kim meeting with a client in her makeshift diner office. She notices a suspicious car around the corner and confronts them because she's Kim. Of course she does. She doesn't just let sleeping dogs lie.
Yeah, and I like that about her.
Mm-hmm.
She goes out there and just gives them what for. makes them tuck their tail and run.
I love it. And knowing later, you know, it's revealed that they are Gus's guys, just knowing that she just officiated them away, basically.
Yeah, so I'm a little disappointed in Mike because they're kind of Mike's guys, right? Like, Mike is the one who's in charge of security for Gus. He's saying,
he's
like,
disappointed in them too.
Hey, the guy I planted at your chicken restaurant, I'll find a new one if he's not up to snuff. Mm-hmm. These guys get made like immediately, by combination of Wendy and Kim, I feel like they're not up to snuff either. What are you doing, Mike? You can't find good help?
Well, he does mention later on that he's stretched very thin because he has people all over town just watching specific areas, just looking for Lalo. Mm-hmm. Where is Lalo?
Well, could have been a good opportunity to see the vet again. That might have been fun.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Nothing in this episode feels wasted. It just feels like it's all moving pieces into place.
It is. It's a 45-minute episode. It's a little shorter than some of the other ones, which, yeah, it felt shorter. By the end, when the episode ended, I was definitely left with a feeling like, oh, okay. I guess that was it.
Yeah.
But that's fine. It's fine sometimes. Oh, and here we are with Jimmy eating his very lonely courtyard lunch. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to sit with him. But then we follow him back to the nail salon, where exactly one person wants Mrs. Nguyen's services.
Right. Yeah, I did notice there was one lady sitting there, like in the hair dryer or whatever.
Yeah, getting her nails did.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Ah, and here is where we see Spooge. Just Spooge. Not Mr. Spooge.
Of course not.
Of course not, because that sounds insane.
Right? No one named Spooge has ever wanted to be called Mr.
Mr.'s my dad. You can call me Spooge.
But you can't call me Daddy.
He looks like Spooge. He would probably like that.
Yeah. Slash and Spooge, it looks like, because that other dude, looking like he stepped off the set of a Guns N' Roses video.
It's pretty good. And everyone in the nail salon knows Jimmy as the guy who got Salamanca off.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how. So it's made its rounds at the courthouse, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe like people over here, ADA talking in the hallway, over here Bill talking about it to whoever Bill hangs out with, nobody talking about it in the mirror to himself.
Yeah.
I assume.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And then the word starts spreading and he's fine. This is the clientele, right? We always thought like, okay, the clientele is going to be the people he sold cell phones to.
Yeah.
I think there's still a little bit of that hanging around, but this is the real Saul Goodman clientele.
Drug people.
The people who, know him as the guy.
Yep.
The man, whatever he calls him.
The magic man. In the next scene, we are back with Miss Kim again, where she is approached by a familiar face. Mike and Kim meeting for the first time, although not really the first time, canonically, I guess, because she recognizes him from the parking. I was getting garage? It is a garage, right?
Yeah, the lot, the garage. I think it's a garage.
Yeah,
at the courthouse. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the significance of that is. Like, why is it important for us to know that she recognizes him?
Maybe just so nobody's like, oh, come on, Kim. You were in and out of the courthouse a million times and you don't recognize this very specific face.
I suppose so. Yeah. Just to keep things consistent.
Yeah.
Might for the audience.
Be kind of a knee-jerk reactionary line.
That makes sense. Here's my question. Will they continue the Howard plan knowing that Mike is watching them? Like he said he doesn't care, right? Mm-hmm. Like you've obviously got stuff going on. I don't care about that. I'm just watching you to make sure person I work for is fine.
I think the real question is now that Kim knows that Lalo's still alive.
Yeah.
How obviously she's still going to put everything that she has into this plan because that's just the kind of person she is. But there's going to be that 10% of her rat brain that's like thinking about Lalo all the time and thinking about like where they are in different stages of their plan physically and how exposed they are to someone like Lalo.
Yeah, it's out of the frying pan into the fire. It's like Mike's absolving her, or not absolving her, but reassuring her, look, okay, these are my guys. They're not after you. They're just keeping an eye for protection for somebody else.
No, a way worse guy's after you.
Right,
actually.
Right. Oh, but this other killer that you've interacted with all the time, he's still alive and he's pissed off. But
you're made of sturder stuff, so you're going to be okay. Maybe don't tell Jimmy. Your husband.
I agree with him there, especially right now.
He's already so shaky.
And always. I mean, I don't know, Saul hardens up a little bit later on, I think. Like, when we're in Breaking Bad time, he's kind of harder than he is now.
He's more used to all this shit.
Yeah, but here, I definitely think Kim is the stronger of the two. She's
definitely
able to deal with more pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so to tell her, and I guess that explains why she doesn't eventually tell Jimmy in this episode, right?
Right. Yeah, it seems like she agrees.
Yeah.
She's way better at compartmentalizing trauma, I think, than Jimmy is.
Mm-hmm.
Or, no, she's better at actually dealing with it. And Jimmy does compartmentalize.
Yeah, he does. But he's also, but also bleeds through, right? I feel like if Kim were to compartmentalize, she would actually be effective at it. Whereas Jimmy tries to, but then the cracks start happening and it all floods in.
I heard that they originally wanted to do this scene outside of the diner, but the light just freaking sucked. The light sucked. It was noisy. So they ended up doing it inside instead. And it was a nice, I like the, that shot of Ray Seahorn at the, of Kim at the counter. And then just the slide over, like you hear his voice first.
Yeah.
And you slide over to Ehrman Trout.
Yeah, it's a good shot. She's like, who are you? Like, do I know you?
Excuse me? And you're going to tell me to sit down? Listen, old man. Okay. Oh, and she does, she acknowledges that he is the guy from the desert that got Jimmy home safe.
Yeah.
So you're the guy. You're the guy from the desert. Another guy.
And the guy from the parking lot.
Yep.
Yeah.
Next, we are going back to Gus's house, where we get a grand tour that takes us through two houses via tunnel. That was cool. There's a lot of little interesting set dressing things in this long shot that I really appreciated.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. So the first house is his real house, the one that he goes into.
Mm-hmm.
And the second house is like a base of operations.
Across the street, yeah.
Yeah, that's through an underground tunnel. He changes before he goes over there out of his work clothes into his other work clothes.
Yeah. I know. He's like, he's changing into casual clothes that are just exactly the same, but different colors.
Yeah.
Essentially. It's nice. We see the world's tiniest ankle gun. Hilarious. We also see the world's thinnest. That is not a bulletproof vest. That is not Kevlar, my friends. I'm sorry. Kevlar plates are bigger than that.
Yeah, that might save you from small caliber.
From a distance.
Shots from a distance. Yeah, something. And I guess, yeah, I don't know.
It makes sense. You can't wear anything bulkier.
Right?
Yeah.
So what's he going to do? Where, like, boy, have you put on weight, Gus? And I mean, looking at him here, you can tell he has between Breaking Bad and now. But
a little bit, yeah. But he just got awful older. Square these days.
Right, yeah. Right. Got a life vest on under that. What's going on?
Yeah. Boy, also, this tub situation, we got to talk about this tub situation in his basement. Why? So we have these shelves, and each shelf is exactly big enough for one tub.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man that just doesn't stack tubs. He doesn't believe in tub stacking.
Yeah, why stack when you could just build a shelf? Because if you stack, you got to take a tub down to get at another tub.
Yeah.
This is more efficient, and Gus is all about efficiency.
When you have exactly, 12 tubs? Yeah, sure. I guess it makes sense to do it this way. The pan over to that, visually speaking, it looks insane.
Yeah.
It looks insane to me.
I mean, he kind of is.
I know.
If he ever gets a 13th tub, he takes it out to the desert and shoots it and buries it in a hole.
He distributes it evenly among all the other tubs.
Yeah. He can never have more than 12 tubs. I don't know. Yeah. This to me looks like heaven. This is the most organized you can possibly be. I love it.
I'm glad that you do. Still, it looks like the basement of someone who is secretly hiding an underground tunnel to me.
Don't look in our laundry room.
Oh, no. Oh, you've been busy. What are the other good little things in this scene. Oh, we get to see that his house connects to the house that we saw in the very beginning of the episode,
right,
with that couple. So there's more context there.
Yeah, they're connecting the dots there a little bit. I do wonder, you know, how this arrangement came to be. Does he go to all of his neighbors and say, hey, I would like to... Why doesn't he just have these people live somewhere else, too? I guess it's a good cover, right? They come mm-hmm. in and it looks like they live there.
Yeah.
He must sleep there. Like, that's the thing. He's using their house as his house. They're roommates, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And his house is just empty, and it's got cameras all over it, and they're waiting for someone to strike.
Yeah. Is he actually staying in that house, or is he staying in his house?
I mean, what would be the point if he stayed in his own house?
To make it look like he lives there, I guess.
It looks like he lives there by him walking the front door every day and leaving through the front door every day, having his car there in the driveway. I think if he were to sleep there, it would defeat the purpose of this, because they could just attack him during night. Like, Lalo could, you know, sneak his way in.
I guess that's fair.
All the Salamanca goons could come in and get him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to know how he built this tunnel without anybody hearing it. There had to have been some blasting involved or something.
Two words. Werner Ziegler.
Ziegler.
No, I don't think he had anything to do with it. But
he did not.
And that raises the question. Like, he clearly had this in place before the Lalo stuff, right? Because you can't just build a tunnel like this with full cement walls and all the type of stuff that's going on here had to be something that was pre-planned before Lalo, before they realized Lalo was still alive.
Yeah.
Or before it must have been part of the plan, right? Like, they knew if they were to try to go after Lalo or Hector or anybody, they would need some facility like this.
Mm-hmm.
They probably had it years ago.
That's fair. I do think Gus has probably always been a little bit of a paranoid bastard.
Yeah. And we see, I think this is the same house. I could be wrong. I think this is the same house he's living in Breaking Bad.
Mm.
Although I remember that being at like the junction of a T.
Yeah, but
like a crossroad kind of thing. But
a lot of people were saying that they recognized it like immediately as Gus's house. Yeah.
And yeah, it makes sense because I think I recognize the kitchen of this place too as the place where he sat down and had a meal with Walter.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. He's clearly not as paranoid, for good reason, I think, in the Breaking Bad timeline.
Yeah.
So I do wonder, like, does this arrangement persist? Is this something where he's always got these people on call at a moment's notice to say, hey, we need to do that thing again. Remember that thing we did that one time? Let's do it again.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
And the other thing about this is he's talking with Mike here about how Mike is stretched thin and the guy he's got working at Los Pollos is not up to Los Pollos standards. And you know, Mike's saying, maybe he's not alive, whatever. Nobody's found him yet. Gus is like, no, Paul Salamanca is alive. And then where is he? And this is the question of the episode. This is the question of the season so far. Where is Lalo Salamanca? What is he up to?
What is he doing? What has he found, if anything? What is he going to do with it?
I still have no idea.
Who's he going after? I don't know either. He is Jaws.
Yeah.
He has Jaws, and I just keep hearing this very faint, way in the distance.
He's not even showing his fin right now. I
know.
He's not even, it doesn't even look like he's ready to attack.
Yeah, no, he just exists as a boogeyman in people's minds right now.
Yeah, somewhere under the water. He attacked, and then he went underwater, and now we're just waiting for him to resurface. It's pretty scary, I think. I've definitely been enjoying the tension there.
Yeah.
But it's also driving me crazy because I want to know.
It's driving me crazy too. I'm very excited for the next episode.
Yeah.
Am I remembering this correctly, that the title for the next episode is Black and Blue?
I remember you mentioned something about that. It could be.
Okay.
It could be next episode. And I mistakenly watched a little bit of The Next Time On, so I think it is going to be a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Man. I actually didn't watch it this time for once.
Yeah, I forgot to turn it off right after the episode was over. So
getting kind of
it.
Annoyed by them because like three times now there's been a line in one of those that seems like it's one thing, but it's actually one other thing that completely makes sense in context and isn't interesting at all.
Yeah.
Stop doing that. Like, I get it, but also stop it.
Right.
And then our final scene, we're with Kim and Jimmy later that night at his new potential office, which we know is his new office.
Yeah.
I recognize that strip mall shape immediately.
Yeah, if I didn't recognize Gus's house, I certainly recognize this.
Yeah.
And I love how he claims, oh, it's just temporary. No, nope. You're going to be in this until you run off to Belize.
Right. It's like Walt and Skyler buying that house and saying that it was temporary and they'd get something bigger.
Right.
When Walt Jr. was older. Nope. You did not.
I was wondering, I was trying to gauge Kim's temperature through this scene because she's worried about, you know, Lalo. She's worried about Jimmy, I think. This office, she doesn't really like it, right? She looks inside. It's dirty. It's smelly. It's small. It's
it smells
got a
weird
toilet
here.
In the middle of it.
It's gutted completely. You're going to have to completely fill this thing.
Yeah.
That's going to be expensive.
And then she pauses for a second after she says it's dirty and small, but it's close to the courthouse. It's close to these other places that you need as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm...
It's a little bit of placation there. Like, I'm going along with your thing because
right.
You're going along with my thing. That's been just about every episode this season.
And she's done this before to him in previous office hunts.
Mm-hmm.
Told him, like, the office is fine, the office is good, but didn't want to join with him. Now she's joined with him in the office. She's just straight up telling him the office is bad, kind of. I don't know. There's definitely, there are rocks in that water. And I'm worried that they're going to hit some. They almost have to.
Definitely. Although, she can only blame herself. She is the one who planted the idea of a cathedral of justice.
Mm-hmm.
So she only has herself to blame here.
Yeah. We'll see how he turns this shitty
as a throne.
Thing into
it
a
has
cathedral
a throne.
Of justice.
It already has a throne. It's perfect.
It does. Yeah. It's not golden yet.
Yet.
What do you think the bathroom in Saul's office looked like?
I bet it was standard. I bet it was normal because his office actually was it all. Well, normal.
I bet he had the
Constitution
printed on the toilet paper. Right. He had to.
I don't know if he did, but I wish that he did.
Yeah.
That would be hilarious.
No, he probably like, I don't know. He made it part of his image to idolize the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and all that stuff. So he probably had like.
I bet he doesn't even have a public bathroom. He doesn't want those people using his bathroom.
Yeah, probably not. Go next door to the nail salon or something.
Right.
And there's one other little detail in the scene that I liked, which is a callback when Kim is talking about that and says she's hungry and Taco Cabeza's down the street. This is a place where Jesse, back in Breaking Bad, when they first meet up with Tuco, says that half of his drug deals have taken place in a Taco Cabeza.
Yeah, appropriate. Well, there you go. It's
yeah.
A perfect location.
Good stuff.
Good stuff. And then the episode just ends.
Mm-hmm. And that means it's time for feedback.
And there's a lot of it.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
I was thinking after the episode last week about the cold open.
Right.
And I realized that that piece of glass that's sitting on the ground is actually a piece of glass that Nacho found in the trash can at the chicken farm.
Oh, yeah.
When Gus, he broke the glass and put it in the trash can.
Oh, that makes sense.
So that was pulled out of there. I'm just shocked that no one wrote in to tell me about this. Nobody wow. said, "Hey, you dummy." Nobody said... Actually, in very polite words, nobody wrote in and said, you must have missed it. Actually, it was in there, and there's a reason for it. I'm lying.
It's incredible.
Lying.
You guys are slipping. you can't even hold the
totally
lie.
Totally lying. Everybody wrote in. Every single listener wrote in to let us know.
Thanks for that. I got some tweets about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you're all right.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense
logically.
Makes sense.
I don't know how I missed this. I missed this like twice watching the episode. Just looking down, making notes, I guess, because it's not super obvious or long shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah, I missed it. So thanks to everybody who wrote in. Michael B. was the first one to write in, so I'll read his email about it real quick. Longtime listener, I didn't catch this until the second watch, but when Nacho is in the chicken house waiting for his final day, he gets to water to drink and looks down at the trash can and sees his reflection in the broken glass that Gus threw away last episode when he broke it with the water pitcher.
That was that reflection that I saw. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It might have been hard to tell what it looked like, too.
It was very dark in that scene.
Yeah.
And I was like you, taking notes. So
very subtle, but it gives a little more meaning and makes the broken glass make more sense. Yes.
Absolutely.
I agree.
Yeah.
So thank you to everyone who did that. We also, in last episode, put a call out for some advice on the legal front. About like what the ADA is getting at here, if
right.
her argument for this attorney-client privilege being null and void might be valid. And we got a couple of lawyers actually writing in. We did put the call out to Doug L. He did write in on Jimmy's legal dilemma here. Said, since you asked, I wanted to answer your question about the DA's suggestion that Jimmy breach attorney-client confidentiality and provide information on Lalo. Your instincts are correct, and it was... a fairly perplexing offer from an ostensibly smart character on a show that generally gets the legal details right. First, as you said last week, criminals are entitled to legal representation. It's enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and it's why public defenders exist. Therefore, any communications between those defendants and their counsel are covered by the attorney-client privilege, with some extremely limited exceptions. The only time a defense attorney could be ethically obligated to breach confidentiality and go to law enforcement is if the attorney has reason to believe the client is about to harm someone else. For example, if a client tells his attorney he's driving off to go kill someone, at that point, the attorney has an ethical obligation to report the client and not sit back and let that violence happen. However, there has to be specific knowledge that the harm is imminent. Knowing your criminal client is generally likely to commit more crimes upon release because of his character is not enough. There has to be a specific threat. And so, you know, Jimmy didn't know that Lalo planned to commit like any specific or harm to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of off the hook for any real ethical obligations there. According to Doug L, we do have another lawyer who wrote in and had some more details to add to that, and maybe even a difference of opinion here. And that's what's, you know, interesting about the law. A, it's super complex.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of different reads on different situations. And B, you can have a difference of opinion based on how you interpret the legal standards there. So let's see what C-Money has to say. He said, I graduated Harvard Law and currently practicing in New York. However, please note, I practice corporate law, so this is not my specialty, though I have practiced some criminal law. And I did conduct some minimal research tonight to confirm a couple of points. Number one, Jimmy's obligation here in regards to Lalo and the prosecution. He says, to your point, Saul's obligation to his client Lalo, he has an obligation to his client Lalo. And it's also true that the worst in society deserve an attorney. This is crucial for very many reasons I won't enumerate here. However, Saul is not allowed to help further criminal activity. This is much different than arguing a guilty client is not guilty, including here but not limited to bail jumping or misrepresenting his identity in court. In fact, ADA Gina's position is that Jimmy is aware of Lalo's true identity, which of course we know he is,
mm-hmm.
and therefore aiding and abetting here in furtherance of crimes committed by Lalo and of him planning to jump bail. He certainly has broken the law and his ethical obligation here, full stop. But ADA's Suzanne has an interesting argument here that if the attorney-client privilege was created under false pretenses, which I think is kind of where they were going with, that he is not obligated to maintain such privilege because it never existed. And of course, we know this also isn't the case, right? Because mm-hmm. he knew exactly who Lalo was. Whole time.
Oh, he knew everything. Yeah.
And while there isn't likely to be a precise binding case on point, or as a general rule, there is a major exception to attorney-client privilege, which is the crime-fraud exception. An attorney is not bound by and can be subpoenaed to share information about legal assistance provided to a client who seeks legal assistance for the purpose of committing a crime or fraud. Of course, mm-hmm. we know that ADA Suzanne's theory, while creative, is incompatible both with the truth and the fact that he dropped Lalo's name to ADA Gina.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting and creative argument that could, in fact, work as the aforementioned exception. So he seems to think that Jimmy does have some culpability here, which I thought was interesting to get two different takes from two different lawyers.
Yeah, that is interesting. Boy, the law. She'd be a tricky mistress, huh?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's why you have to study for years and years.
Right.
And it's not easy to become a lawyer.
Yeah.
He also had some information about Kim sharing this prior arrest record mm-hmm. As part of discovery, which we talked about a bit. He says it was an extremely frustrating moment for him. Typically, the burden is on the prosecution to share information with the defendant's counsel. While there are certainly limited circumstances where the defendant's counsel must also provide information, which is called reciprocal discovery, a prior arrest record from a different jurisdiction is highly unlikely to be one of them. Moreover, while I can't envision a hypothetical and very unlikely scenario where this was somehow a legitimate question posed by the prosecution that the defense must somehow answer or provide, the underlying fact of the matter is that Kim is breaking several ethical rules by both working against her client's interest and using her client to influence other cases or advance other goals. So Kim's in the wrong, too. Everybody's in the wrong.
Oh, jeez. Boy.
Yeah, so thank you to Doug L. and C Money for writing in about those topics. We got a ton of email this week, so I'm trying to like both speed through the stuff that we could read and also apologize to everyone whose emails I had to either cut the legs off of to get to fit into it or just straight up cut.
And I appreciate them. I'm trying to jam you into a plastic tub here.
Yeah, yeah, it's... We've only got 12 of them. If you were the 13th, you're gone. Taking you out to the desert. Dan writes in and says, in the episode 3 recap, you asked why the cousins picked up Hector's wheelchair and carried him to Nacho's body.
Yes, please explain.
Dan thinks it was done to portray Hector's complete impotence. Hector was betrayed by Nacho when he swapped his medication over to induce the stroke, which left him wheelchair bound. His pride would mean that he had to get some kind of revenge on him, but he had to be carried to the body to do it and looked pathetic. So it was a, according to Dan, an artistic flourish here that, you know, if he could have been wheeled over there, it doesn't look quite as pathetic as being carried over there.
I feel like being carried over there is more dramatic than pathetic. I feel like you're sort of flexing your powers there. Like you mentioned before, it's like a litter, right?
Yeah. I think of like Egyptian rulers. I think of Persians, I don't know, the carrying people around on daises, right?
And the way the cousins are so monochromatic and similar and very, they move in a mirrored kind of way. It makes it feel even more like that to me personally, but that was just my interpretation.
Yeah.
I like yours though. Good show.
All right. Sean S. Sent in a screenshot from previous episode, season 4, episode 8, actually, and said, I thought you'd appreciate that this line from our introduction to Lalo proved to be right, where you remember if the first time we see Lalo, Nacho comes into the taco shop, and Lalo's in the back in the kitchen cooking, I think eggs? I can't remember exactly what he's cooking.
It's usually...
Maybe a frittata or something, I don't know.
I was going to say, it's usually taco fillings.
Yeah, so somebody will know what that is, but when he turns around, he says, you're going to die with the plate held out. And he's talking about his eggs or his whatever.
Right.
Because they're so good. But yeah, a little prophetic.
And also, you won't even know I'm here.
Right.
Very also prophetic.
Totally. All right. Mason wrote in and said, Saul seems to be nowhere near the level of immorality that we find him during Breaking Bad. Currently. Not sure how they get there in so few episodes. If you recall, in the very first episode we meet Saul, he encourages Walt and Jesse to kill Badger. Sweet, simple, innocent Badger, relatively.
Oh, Badger.
Right? He's the first but not the last person we see Saul suggesting to send on a trip to Belize. He goes on to try and convince Walt to kill both Hank and Jesse. Jesse, his own client. The Saul we know right now isn't even as morally flexible as Kim. Feels like it will take something earth-shattering to push him to the place where he's so casually discussing killing people.
I mean, that's one of the things that we're waiting for in this final season. We want to see what is that thing that finally makes him essentially give up on humanity.
Yeah.
And just go for money. What is it?
I don't know. I really don't know yet.
Is it Kim-related?
It's got to be Kim-related.
It's got to be Kim-related.
It's got to be Kim-related.
And she needs to stop wearing blue. She needs to stop wearing blue. She'd make me nervous. Make me nervous,
blue
girl.
Blue is death, red is danger, it's all... What color can she wear? Yellow?
No, she can't wear yellow either.
Ah.
Didn't Jesse used to wear yellow?
I mean, yeah. A hoodie or two. But Gus wears yellow all the time. He'll be around for a while.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe chicken color is a safe color.
Yeah. Elliot G. says, it's interesting that when you watched episode 3, there was no trigger warning for suicide before the show. I'm in the UK, and on Netflix, there was a suicide warning. This was a shame for him, as it meant from the start, I guess Nacho would be taking his death into his own hands.
Yeah.
What's your feeling on that? Like,
providing
the warning,
which
might actually spoil something.
I don't know that I would have immediately jumped to Nacho, but that's just me. I mean, what's more important? What's more important here? Some people's enjoyment of a show or other people's enjoyment of a show, right? Like maybe some people want to like sort of steel themselves for something that's coming.
Yeah.
But then, you have the people who are spoiler paranoid.
Yeah, I think this,
you can't make everybody happy, right?
Totally.
I think we watched it on Amazon, not Netflix. Maybe that was a...
Could be, yeah.
Yeah.
If I'm playing the devil's advocate here for the spoiler phobes, and I'm not like a huge spoiler phobe in most cases, but they would say, well, just wait until the episode is out and read a review to be sure that there isn't anything in there. But I will say most reviews don't warn you of things like this. Like, you're not going to go into a review and without spoiling yourself, like knowing exactly what happens, then you just won't get these warnings. So I feel like, yeah, putting these on front of shows is better than not doing it. But that's just like my opinion, man.
Yeah.
All right, Sean G says, first, I remember hearing a lot of people describe Nacho as the Jesse Pinkman of Better Call Saul, as someone who was always compelling, but gradually went from just a criminal to a character we loved and wanted to escape the drug world. I think everyone wanted Nacho and his father to escape to Canada, which is why I think it was so necessary that they killed him off so we didn't just repeat Jesse's story of escaping to Alaska. Secondly, I absolutely love the cathartic moment of Nacho revealing to Hector the events around the pill swap.
Yeah.
I'm really surprised you didn't pick up on how that moment was almost an inverse of the I watched Jane die moment from Ozymandias from Breaking Bad. They're both a main character revealing something horrible they did a long time ago to another character. But this time, we're actually supporting it rather than horrified by it. I thought it was a nice callback. You're right. You're right. That is kind of a weird funhouse mirror, because the thing here is the character who's saying it we're rooting for more than the character it's being said to, right?
Yeah.
Like, I watched Jane die is a horrible thing to say to someone who we care for very much. The other way around is happening here, right? Like, I put you in that chair is exactly what we wanted this character to say to a horrible person.
Yes.
That we hate.
Yeah. I'm glad he got that jab in at the end.
Yeah.
Die mad about it, asshole.
But I do think there is, yeah, like a funhouse mirror callback there.
That's, yeah, no, good. Cool. That's a good thing to point out.
All right. And now we're up to the episode 4 emails from this week. Josh H starts off with RIP to the Kim is Wendy theory. Were you privy to this?
As of today, I was aware of this.
Okay.
Nonsense.
All right.
Yeah. Go on.
For people who...
stupid.
It was always stupid. I mean, there's no chance in hell that Kim ever turns into Wendy. I mean, I just couldn't see it, right? Like, the actors aren't that far apart. The bone structure's not even the same.
Yeah, like, what?
Age?
They're both blonde?
Right.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. And in retrospect, it's obviously stupid, but it was fun while it lasted. And Josh H. agrees. It was good. It had a good run while it lasted. Now that we're down to single digits remaining for Better Call Saul episodes, are either of you ready to start making official predictions about Kim's ultimate fate? Especially now that one, perhaps somewhat unlikely possibility is off the board. I'm really not ready. And we talked about this pretty extensively in that stream I did a couple of weeks ago with Pete Peppers, where the guys from One Take had a pretty good idea on what might happen. But man, I'm just not sure.
Not willing to commit to anything.
I don't know if Kim's around in Breaking Bad. I feel like there's room for that to be true. But then what drives Jimmy to become full-time Saul?
Yeah, for my part, I think she's dead. I think she's out.
It would make a certain amount of sense.
And it's going to be a crossfire kind of thing. I don't think it'll be what was meant to happen in that moment, whatever the moment ends up being. And that will make it 10 times more tragic.
Yeah. I mean,
it's going to be rough. Yeah, no matter what. I don't know that I buy her just being on the sidelines the whole time through all of Breaking Bad. That seems...
It would feel pretty dissatisfying, I think.
Yeah.
Like, to see Saul come back and interact with Walt and Jesse so much, interact with Huel, interact with all these people we know from Better Call Saul, or, you know, the beyond that we get to know through Breaking Bad, but never see Kim even once.
Yeah.
Never even mention Kim, right? Like, that's the other thing. I feel like they will do something with this phone call, though, right? Because there's the phone call that Jimmy as he's packing up to go to Nebraska, to flee the country or
at
the state.
At the end of Breaking Bad, yeah.
At the end of Breaking Bad, that he tells Francesca to be there to take a call at a very specific time.
Mm-hmm.
Who could that possibly be from other than Kim?
That's a good question.
But
do you think that's going to be their
very super dissatisfying
connection
for the rest of the time, though, right?
Yeah, because you're fridging her.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Completely.
Not even essentially, you are. You're literally fridging her. Kind of like we've been fridging Lalo.
Yeah, for three episodes, yeah. I don't know. We did have some email come in about that with possible theories, but let's get to this. So Norm says, hey all, wow, Kim meets Mike. It was kind of underwhelming, but still awesome. I'm glad we had this week's set piece episode after last week's Nacho Demise episode, but like the smell of Jimmy's new office, the smell of Lalo permeates this whole episode. And I think the smell of the end of Kim, the legal improprieties don't catch Jimmy, they catch up to Kim. She gets ensnared in his mess and he lets her hang. She pays the price for his sins and transgressions. What do you think?
Interesting.
Any chance that like all this scheming comes back on her and Jimmy just lets it happen?
It doesn't feel like the right direction to me personally, based on
what would be the thing, right? Why would Jimmy do that? There'd have to be some circumstance that would make him hang Kim out to dry.
I feel like she would have had to have betrayed him first in some way.
Maybe a betrayal combined with his life being threatened somehow.
Maybe.
I could see that happening.
Yeah.
Once Lalo's back in the picture.
I do think, though, that treating Kim as sort of the innocent party is not... that doesn't fly with me anymore. It shouldn't have flown with me last season either, because she was already starting to slip. But she was kind of the paragon through a lot of this, but she isn't that person anymore.
No,
she's becoming a different person, and I think that her ending, whatever that ends up being, is going to reflect that more so than her being an innocent caught up in, or like the fall guy or something. I think she's going to bring it on herself, whatever it ends up being.
I guess I do think it's more likely that she ends up surviving this series than like Lalo surviving, because that's the other thing, right? Like Lalo
does too much. He's a rabid dog. He's gonna have to be put down, otherwise he would absolutely affect Breaking Bad.
That's the thing. Yeah. you can't just fridge him.
And that's the
if
same.
You could fridge Kim, he's like 10 times that. You just can't fridge him.
Yeah, well, that's the same feeling that I have about Kim and fridging her. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like you can't really do that either with her actions this season and the end of last season.
Yeah.
She's too in control of her own shit,
I think. Would feel super unsatisfying if Lalo was just alive at the end of the series and we never, like, the next time we hear about him is the last time.
Yeah.
And you never see him again, nothing.
Yeah.
Maybe they can make a sort of finality to the story that doesn't involve death, but it feels like he's got to die.
I think so. I think he just has too much agency. It's not believable that he would just like put his tail between his legs and crawl back to Mexico. Like, no, I don't think so.
I don't know. Maybe Kim goes to prison.
It doesn't go with his character. Yeah,
maybe
Kim's
Jimmy
in prison.
Tries to help her but can't.
Yeah.
And Kim gets caught up in their shenanigans. And
now that, that's an interesting angle. Dead or prison.
Because then, you know, that phone call could be like, I don't know, a weekly call they do from prison or something. Or like her getting out of prison, right? Like he was supposed to go pick her up, but he's going to get a call and he's not going to be there. So he needs someone to tell her that. Who knows? But... yeah, I don't see Kim dying, but I also, something has to change in that relationship because I can't see her just being there in the background and never being mentioned.
Yeah, it doesn't seem right.
All right, Doug L. again writes in for episode 604. It didn't feature any particularly meaty legal issues, but if there's something specific we have questions about, he's always happy to answer them. One thing I will note is the plan to embarrass Howard to force the Sandpiper settlement seems suspect to me. It seems like the plan is to make Cliff doubt Howard's fitness, and that will make him want to simply be done with the case. The flaw in that argument is that we've seen how big HHM is. If Cliff really had no confidence in Howard, one solution would be to force HHM to have the case handled by a different attorney there. If that happened, all of Kim and Saul's work will have been funny and perhaps satisfying in terms of taking Howard down a peg, but it may not achieve the required result. And of course, for any settlement to happen, the client has to sign off on it as well. Frankly, this seems like taking on a lot of risk to force a settlement that will likely occur relatively soon anyway, within a matter of a few years at most, likely less. I hope that, as usually happens, the writers are a few steps ahead of us on what the plan is actually about. Anyway, those are my only thoughts for now. All the best. Yeah, I didn't really think about that, right? Because they have used the size of HHM and the various number of attorneys that they have, or various attorneys they have at their disposal as a plot point before.
Yeah, that's true. That is a good point.
Why would muscle, they? You know, Jimmy off the Kettleman case, for instance, right?
Right.
Or the Sandpiper thing early on.
Yeah, why would they not just pivot to somebody else? That
and I could see if they wanted to make that a point and have like maybe Howard's pride or something get in the way, but it doesn't really feel like Howard anymore. He doesn't seem like too proud of a guy. He seems more like he's regulated that. But I don't know.
It's interesting. I want to see these characters break.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, but I do.
Yeah. I want to see Howard driven mad. Driven just fully insane.
That's another character that we don't hear anything about at all in Breaking Bad, right?
Howard? Yeah. Not at all.
I don't know why we would, but also we don't. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I do hope there are a couple of steps ahead of us here.
Yeah.
Maria from upstate New York says, I had a question and thoughts about Jimmy and Kim's whole scam on Howie Ham. I know his actual name, but I like this nickname. I'm not sure if I just didn't catch it, but wasn't he at a meeting or something when Jimmy pulled that scam? So if Ed Begley Jr.'s character confronts him, wouldn't he have pretty good proof that he didn't do what Jimmy tried to make it appear he did? This is what you were talking about earlier with him being in the therapy session, probably having a pretty good alibi.
Right.
Not even being in that. But it's hard. It's really hard to refute your own vanity plate on your own car.
Yeah.
With a silhouette that looks exactly like you. I mean, you can say that, but you're going to have to go to great lengths to prove it, right? You're going to need to take Cliff, who doesn't even live in the city, take Cliff to your therapist or have your therapist call him personally, assure him that you were there,
and
believe that he is who he says he is.
And like, that he's not just been paid to give this alibi.
Exactly.
Because anybody, and that's Jimmy's thing. That's conning. That's confidence.
Everywhere.
Exactly. That's what he does, is he throws doubt onto everything, and then people's own shit is what ends up bringing them down. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. Also, why don't you think Kim told Jimmy about Lalo?
Because Jimmy's weak. He's a weak little baby. He can't handle such information.
I think you're right. I think she heard Mike say that and she was like, oh no, actually you're totally correct.
Yeah, no, you called
it. He's not.
Especially this season. He is way shakier than we have seen him.
And we've seen Kim notice it too, right?
We have.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
She's pushing him into the things that he normally would volunteer to do or would be his ideas.
Right. And she can see him squirming about it, but still going along with it. Again, mutual support.
All right, Reginald says, in Breaking Bad, Gus was usually so composed and calculating. He was manipulative. Gus could be charming or intimidating. He was extremely powerful, but still ambitious. Gus was a force of nature. But Gus has been unraveling in the last two episodes of Better Call Saul. In Hit and Run, we see that his monstrous paranoia has come to dominate his entire organization. He's no longer the all-powerful boogeyman. He has flaws and makes mistakes and is sometimes scared himself. But I like it. Seeing a more rounded view of a character always makes them more interesting. That is definitely the case with Gus Fring. How do you feel about that?
I agree. I totally agree. It humanizes him a little bit more, which just gives us something more interesting to chew on with his character than just constant, I am Gus. I'm very serious. Yeah.
And I feel like the thing we haven't lost with Gus is the sense of outward composure, right? Yeah. That front.
Absolutely.
And that's what you see in Breaking Bad until Walt starts to, you know, ice pick away at that thing. You just see constant composure. So I don't think they've really done any damage to Gus in this series. I don't think like you could point to Breaking Bad and say, well, now it's not consistent with his character, because his character in Breaking Bad is a facade.
Yeah.
And it, just like it is in Better Call Saul.
Mm-hmm.
That stoicism, that...
And the toughness, yeah.
Yeah, that's all...
That everything is under control here.
It's all a put-on, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then Reginald also has some comparisons to... This being May the 4th, the day we're recording this, has some comparisons to Star Wars. After revealing that he is the father, Darth Vader told Luke Skywalker that by teaming up, they could rule the galaxy. Nacho had potential, Mike is skillful, and Gus is highly intelligent. So what do you think about this? If Nacho, the Skywalker, had originally joined Gus, the Vader, instead of the Salamancas, could they have been an unbeatable team? Along with Mike, the Han Solo? The Han Solo, you say. Okay, yeah.
Hmm.
Maybe. He was Solo to start with. They could have easily taken out Lalo, the Salamancas, and Don Eladio, the Emperor. Does that make sense?
So the only reason why Nacho ever really wanted out of the drug stuff in the first place, I think, was because the Salamancas were just like constantly threatening his dad, basically, indirectly.
I think you're right.
Trying to pull him into it. And Gus is not above fucking with family members. So I don't know that it would have ended all that differently. He may have ended up, Gus may have put himself in the same position as Hector.
Well, I mean, the reason Hector wanted, like, even started thinking about Nacho's dad is because he lost his autonomy in this drug smuggling operation, right? Like, he, Mike came in, blew up his, the whole operation he had with the ice cream trucks.
Right.
And so he wasn't able to get his product in. He was losing money. He was losing the faith of Eladio.
Yeah.
And so he needed a new source, a new way to get stuff into the country.
And that's why he started.
And so he went after Nacho's dad.
Yeah.
I don't think Gus ever would have done that, because Gus has the chicken operation.
Right.
Gus has no need to go after family. And so if Gus, you know, and so if Nacho's working with him, he becomes the victor. He becomes the...
I guess that's fair.
Whoever in Gus's operation.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I mean, I think it would have worked out a hell of a lot better for Nacho. I don't know that he'd be out, and I don't know that they would, like, rule the galaxy together, but, like, definitely he would have been safer in the parts of the operation he participated in.
Yeah. I think you're probably right about that. Just overall, he would still be, he'd be doing the same shit, but maybe he wouldn't have to rip the gauges out of people's ears or anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe he would. I don't know. Difficult to say.
And finally, Paul says, greetings from Germany. Love your podcast and Better Call Saul, obviously. And had a thought about the whole watching Better Call Saul before Breaking Bad discussion that you had in the episode 3 podcast. Without knowing the Saul from Breaking Bad, does the opening scene of episode 1, not of this season, but of Better Call Saul, of all of it, make any sense? I guess you could ask the question for every Gene scene, but I feel like you don't really get or could enjoy this scene as someone who knows everything about the Saul from Breaking Bad. I'd like to know what you think about it. I mean, that is the scene where we see him in a Cinnabon, right? Just making the...
And looking real sad.
Cinnabons, yeah.
No, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense in context.
I think it makes more sense when you see the actor in the second scene.
Yeah.
Or right. Whenever Jimmy shows up for the first
time,
I think
it is. When you see him looking younger and spryer.
Right. I assume, like, you could pick up on that. They're like, oh, this is an older version of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just kind of, like, telling you where this all leads. Maybe. It's certainly not as obvious as if you've seen Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I don't think you would understand the greater context, but I think you're right. I mean, anybody can look at a balding character in black and white and then the same character with hair in color and be like, oh, okay, that must be the future. Like, it's not that hard to figure out.
Then what do you make of Howard face? if the hair makes the man. What timeline is Howard face on?
It's a multiverse situation.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all a multiverse right. situation.
So parallel timelines. It's just, yeah, this is like Twilight Zone. This is what you could have been.
In the scary door. Yep.
All right. Well, that's it for the episode, for our feedback
for
this
week's
coverage.
Thanks for hanging
out with us. Yeah. It's been fun. We'll be back next week, of course. If you'd like to send in more emails, preferably not about the piece of glass. We got that out of the way. No more tweets about it.
We got it.
I did seriously get like 35 emails about that. You can do so at bcs@baldmove.com. Send your emails. We will be back, of course, on Wednesday evening next week to talk about the third to last episode in this chunk. I'm trying to think. Is it 5, 6, 7 left?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds right.
And I guess that's it. We'll see you then. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis.